Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 21st, 2002. And this session at Holden is called Mountain Stories, Mont Blanc, 200 Years of Alpinisme. It is presented by Jonathan Ferrix, and it is tape number FRJ2002-08. Let's listen in.
Welcome to session number 3 of a series that talks about God-made wildernesses compared to last week when I was talking about man-made wildernesses. Last year was about war and deprivation and chaos and strife. And this week, it's about places on earth that are wildernesses, usually in the mountains. And so the stories are a little less complicated than they were last week. And they have nothing to do with work per se. I work for Lutheran World Relief. My name is Jonathan Ferrix. And this is an avocational series. Last week was a vocational series. And it's about Mont Blanc. Everybody know what Blanc means?
White.
Yeah, so the highest mountain in Europe has the distinguished name of being called White Mountain. And don't we have White Mountain, the White Mountains in New Hampshire?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Has anybody been to Mont Blanc or to Chamonix? Two? All right. Feel free to jump in and elaborate on your own memories. You were there as a tourist?
Unlike you, who walked up to the top, we walked all the way
around. Oh, you did the circuit?
Yes.
Great. I'd like to hear you describe that a little bit. I'll come to that. I wanted to mention that circuit. And how about, I can't remember your name?
Bonnie. Yeah, my husband was interested in climbing, and we went there, and it was completely fogged in. So
yeah.
So the weather determines a lot of stuff.
Right. What I thought I would do in this hour was give you a bit of the lay of the land, give a little bit of the history of the first ascent, describe the climb that I was involved in, which was on the 200th anniversary of the first ascent, August 7th, 1986. And then broaden it a little bit and talk about hiking and climbing in the Alps, the sort of system within which it works, especially based on Switzerland and somewhat on France. So that's my intention. And I have to apologize, I misplaced a box of slides that weren't going to show Mont Blanc. I got some prints of this first part of the story. But I had some slides of a mountaineering training course I was on as a member of the Swiss Alpine Club. Chef de course, they call it in French, the outing leader. I was taking a week-long winter course in being a leader for the club, Swiss Alpine Club, and I have some nice slides of that instruction, but I couldn't find them here, and so I'll just describe a little bit about that as well. So if you came with slides on your brain, I'll close my eyes and you can leave if you're disappointed about that. Let me just say that what continent does the country of Italy lie on? Because Mont Blanc here is in France, but just over the ridge is Italy, and over here is Switzerland. And when you walked around, you went through all three countries, right?
Yes.
What continent does Italy lie on?
Continent.
Europe? Well, it does in our way of looking at the world above the sea level. But if you looked underneath at what
must be on
the plates they're on, Italy is on the African plate. And it's relevant here because why are the Alps so sharp, and why are they formed the way they're formed? Because Italy is on the African plate and it's being driven into the belly of Europe, like that. And so the plates of the strata of rock in the European plate are colliding with the strata of rock in the African plate, which is Italy, and the mountains are being pushed up like this, and so you get an effect in the Alps where a lot of the north-facing slopes are more gentle and the south-facing slopes are more steep. This is oversimplifying. And it's not always true because anybody heard of the Eiger Nordwand, the north face of the Eiger? It's like maybe some of you have seen it. and it's pretty vertical, and it's a north-facing slope, so that's an exception. But generally, the Alps are a bit like this, because Italy is thrusting there and buckling up the European plate. And I'm not a geologist, but I think that the Alps are younger than the Cascades. They're a very young range of mountains, so you have this irony of the most heavily used mountain range in the world being one of the youngest mountain ranges, geologically speaking, in the world. Mont Blanc itself is more or less this kind of a shape. And let me describe for you some of the things here. This is called Aiguille de Midi. And if you go to Mont Blanc, there is a cable car coming up from Chamonix right to here, and then you go through a tunnel and you come out the other side of this mountain. There's a restaurant up there, there's an observation platform, and you have a spectacular view of the huge high shoulder of Mont Blanc that lies beyond the ridge you can see from the Chamonix Valley, and goes for quite some extent and then drops out very sharply. And the south walls of Mont Blanc are a lot sharper and a lot harder than the north walls. Today's route that we're describing is the general tourist route, and it's a very gentle climb by the standards of climbs to get to that height. But on the other side are some incredibly steep routes on the south face facing Italy. There's a real interesting thing going on here at Aiguille de Midi. It's the highest cable car in Europe. It may be the highest cable car in the world. Did you
we didn't go up.
Go up it?
It was foggy.
In the clouds. In the clouds. And I had already had an interesting experience with Aiguille de Midi. When you live and work in Geneva, as I did at the time with Lutheran World Federation, and if you're a skier, you hear about the Vallée Blanche. Vallée Blanche is the White Valley. This is the White Mountain, and starting here is the White Valley. And it's a very popular outing to go to the Vallée Blanche very early in the day, take the first cable car up, and then ski for 15 miles down the glacier that starts up here on this flat. And it's like going to Antarctica for 4, 5, or 6 hours, because you're skiing, glacier skiing is typically quite gentle, but you have to avoid the crevasses which exist on the glaciers. Anybody been up to Holden Lake and looked at Mary Green above Holden Lake and seen the crevasses? If you climb a little higher on the side there towards the pass, we were up on the glacier Sunday, and there are glaciers there that you could drop all of our school buses into, right on Mary Green, and that's a tiny little glacier that's retreating rapidly. But the Vallée Blanche is a 15-mile ski over a glacier, and because of the cable car, 70 people can go at a time. I think every 10 minutes there's a gondola with 70 people going up there. And the day we chose to climb, to ski it, we got up at 4, we're in the car at 5, we're at the cable car at 6 o'clock in the morning, in line to be in the first or second gondola. But they were slow in opening, and we hadn't really had breakfast, and we wandered off for that great European institution, a cup of coffee, strong coffee. And we came back, and they had filled and sent the first two gondolas. And then the next, I think, 20 gondolas, 25 gondolas, were booked for a real phenomenon that happens in Chamonix and all over Europe, especially when their economy was stronger, Japanese honeymooners. And the parking lot was full. You know, you do the math, 70 people per gondola, 25 gondolas. How many people is that? They had all arrived in buses. Their tour said, this day is your day to go to Aiguille de Midi on your honeymoon. Package tour of Europe on your honeymoon. And I say it, this was 1985 maybe, so the Japanese economy was really cooking. They may have dropped off a little bit now. So we had to wait from 6 a.m. till noon to get onto a gondola again. And by that time, a beautiful clear day that would have allowed for a wonderful clear ski. And you can take 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. You can have a picnic along the way if you want to on this ski all the way back around the back of the mountain and down to Chamonix if the snow is low enough. From 4,000 meters down to Chamonix at 1,000 meters. But by that time it was cloudy and misty, and instead of a beautiful ski, we had a kind of a marginal ski where you had to not get too far away from each other because we had one guy who really knew the way, and you should take a guide if you ski the Vallée Blanche. And so we had to stay together, and I remember one of our party, we had five people, one guy fell over right away because of the disorientation when you have a near whiteout. And if you fall and slide, you could fall and slide into a glacier. And there's a phenomenon in this Chamonix area that is really very relevant to the discussion. About 100 tourists die each year. Mostly tourists. Some of them are climbers and some of them are good climbers, but some of them are tourists climbing, others just tourists, because you can get to very high altitudes very easily, and nobody's going to stop you if you walk through the tunnel at Aiguille du Midi and you walk down this catwalk. There's a cable on the side of the mountain and a little path that the skiers take, and you could go out onto the glacier and, you know, explore crevasses for yourself if you wanted to. And some people do that, and they regularly do something wrong. So you have, I think, probably the highest number of people who didn't work to get there at high altitude anywhere in the world in Chamonix, France. And it costs about 100 lives a year. And the joke on the Vallée Blanche is that a party was skiing down. They had a guide. The guide had a rope just for security in case somebody did fall in a crevasse. And one of the skiers fell into a crevasse. And so the party stopped, and the guide got his stuff out and got ready and set up an anchor and let the rope down and said, you know, ready, okay, you know, attach yourself, here we come. And they pull it up, and another person comes out of the river. Because it's so crowded. I mean, 500 people can ski the Vallée Blanche on a nice day. And somebody else had fallen in and nobody noticed. So when the second guy fell in, they talked and they said, well, you've been here longer, why don't you go up first? And I can't say for sure it happened, but when you see the number of people there, you believe that it probably did happen. Let me point out a couple other features. The top is 4,607 meters, and that translates into about 16,000 and something feet. Okay? Like I did the other day, let's stick to meters. Can you all do a little math and just triple it and add 10% and get feet out of meters? But this is higher than anything in the lower 48, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, a little bit. And it's a big, massive mountain. This side isn't that imposing, except for its sheer bulk. The other side has some really steep routes on it. There are some features to point out. These are two rock bars that figure in the story of the first ascent. And they're permanently free of snow because they're so steep, they don't get covered. You have snow basically from, just very generally, you have snow from about there on up. And it is really a white mountain. I mean, we could see it from Geneva all the time on good days. And in the morning sun and the afternoon sun, I mean, it's a very imposing peak for its sheer size, sort of like McKinley is. There's a hut here called the Grand Mulet, an alpine hut on a bar of rock that sticks out of the Bossong Glacier. And there's a huge glacier here, which has actually threatened the villages below in historic memory quite frequently. Now it's retreating, like most glaciers. But it flows between these two bars of rock, and a lot of the ascent takes place on the Bossong Glacier. Does it have an S? I never know with French. I don't think it does. The Bossong Glacier. Another bar of rock there. And then something called the Grand Plateau, which is exactly what it sounds like in English. A cable car to about 2,700 meters here. So if you really want to go up it fast, you take the cable car to 2,700 and just walk up that ridge. There's a cabin, mountain hut, conveniently situated above that cable car where you can spend the first night. And then another one called Refuge du Vallon, which is pretty high and pretty tinny and pretty small and pretty dirty and pretty cold, but you can get out of the wind. And you're not very far from the summit, maybe 3 hours from the summit or two at that point. And the route that we took, which is pretty much the standard route, is to come to the tunnel entrance. This is a 13-mile tunnel right underneath the mountain that comes out in the Val d'Aoste in Italy. And if you remember the news of a couple of years ago, was it 99 or 2000? a truck flipped or hit something and burned, and I think 30 people were trapped or more, and the tunnel's been closed. I think it's still closed, isn't it? Yeah. Anybody know?
I think it was last year.
Last year or the year before, I mean, a horrendous accident. There was another one in Germany or Austria not too far before. And Switzerland, too, I think there were three tunnel accidents. But this tunnel is a main artery to get through the Alps. You know, the Alps have always protected Italy or protected Europe, whichever way you're looking. And the famous passes of Great St. Bernard, Little St. Bernard, are all able to be forgotten if you use this tunnel. You pay a pretty hefty thing and through you go, but they had this horrible accident in, and many people were trapped. We parked our car right near it and then started out, and you do a whole bunch of switchbacks, just like going to Lyman Lake. And then you kind of traverse across, and you come to, this is a bit wrong, you come to below this bar of rock, and you put on your crampons and ropes, and you go up to this hut. And so we started at about, I think it was 3 o'clock, 3:30, something like that. 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock, got to here at about 6 o'clock. So about 5 hours to this hut, the Grand Mulet hut, and spent the night there. Very typical in alpine climbing in the Alps is to get to a hut, spend the night, and then go to the summit the next day. We got up the next morning at 2, I think, and we're leaving 2:15, left by about 3:20, and went roughly like this, so that you know what I'm talking about as I describe a few things, across the glacier, and around, and up the steep part, and then onto the Grand Plateau, and then you kind of swing around, and you come out here on this ridge, and then you climb this ridge. You can stop there and get out of the wind if you like, and then all the way to there. And then we return by the same route. And I think if we left here at 3 a.m., we were on the top at, 10? I think it was 10. So, you know, you're not talking about weeks or days. You know, you think of Everest expeditions that last. I mean, this is small potatoes. It's big snow, and it's got real high alpine mountain characteristics because it's relatively high and relatively far north. I think probably more fun would be to do what you did, and certainly a fuller vacation. 10 days?
This was 2 weeks.
2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, not to be rushed and to really savor the experience.
Right. Where did you start? This is a circuit around it's the...
We started at Chamonix, and we just got ourselves over there. The meeting place is at a campground just outside of Chamonix. Mm-hmm. And we came in a couple days ahead of time and, you know, just explored. Took that cable car up to the Aiguille du Midi, and they were paragliding off it at that point. Vast numbers of people paragliding down into Blois.
Yeah.
And there's even a movie theater up there. You know, here's this vast tower of rock, and you think nobody could ever ascend it. You get up there, and there's the restaurant and the movie theater. And
built into the mountain.
Built right into the mountain.
Yeah.
It's and observation decks all the way around.
Any Japanese honeymooners?
No, we were there the wrong day. Good views of the mountain. And then our group met. We had one day of just kind of doing things, and went up to the halfway point, and then took a long trail down to the Mer de Glace, that glacier.
That's at the Vallée Blanche, the end of it.
At the end, and then took a little train back on down.
Right.
But the trip around was tenting the whole way.
Carry
but we didn't
food
carry
or?
The tents, you know. There was a support vehicle that would go from tent spot the long way around to the next valley and deliver the tents again. We put them up. And there were about 10 of us all together. It was the Exodus organization that out of England that provided this, all British people.
Oh.
And half the nights we were in towns, and half the nights we were just out in the bushes someplace, some remote campground. Started at Chamonix, and then went into Switzerland, and then into Italy, and then, in France, and into Switzerland, and then Italy, and then back into France.
It's roughly like this, just to get some geography. Italy carries around to about here, I think. Maybe not quite. And then most of the circumference is France, more about half, I think. So you're in France a lot of the time. You cross into a bit of Switzerland, a very pretty part. And there's a lot of other mountains here that you have to go around because they're so high. And some are more spectacular than Mont Blanc, really. The Argentier, for example. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I think it's a great circuit. Gets up to about 10,000 feet or 9,000 feet.
I don't recall the highest elevation. I just know we went September and it was marvelous weather the entire time.
Yeah. Great month. Yeah, well, that's something to put on your hiking schedule if you're a hiker. It's interesting to say that why is it in France? You know how a lot of boundaries are drawn by the watershed. So a lot of boundaries follow a ridgeline. And if there would be a ridgeline they ought to share, it would be this one. But no, I think France must have been more powerful when they drew the line. And so the boundary goes way over across this shoulder. I think the whole Vallée Blanche is in France, and the other side where it starts to get steep, then you finally get to Italy. But so the summit of Europe is in France, and of course they're proud of that. A little word about how it was first climbed. Remember that mountains in most cultures have been places where spirits live. Yes, 2 days ago we talked about Kilimanjaro, and people talk about how your brain, your knees would stiffen up, and your gunpowder wouldn't work, and the summit would recede from you, and I think those are folkloric descriptions of altitude sickness and fatigue symptoms. Some of the same thing happened in Europe, and there were spirits and fear. They called it Mont Maudit before they called it Mont Blanc, and Mont Maudit means sinister mountain, mountain of evil, really evil mountain, before they called it Mont Blanc. The church got involved through the Middle Ages when these records start to be written down, and every so often they'd get a bishop up to kind of, you know, hold back the glacier, bless the village below it, to say, please protect this village from the glaciers, because the glaciers would come down and wipe out homes, farms, villages, sometimes, or blocks of ice would fall. Still today, when you live in Switzerland, big boulders come down off the mountain and go crashing through villages occasionally. And so you live with that sense. And if you didn't have the science and the ease of travel that we have, it wouldn't be hard to develop a sense that there were evil things up there, and because it was such a hostile environment, you wouldn't even try. But it was first climbed in 1786, and that's pretty early for an alpine ascent that we know about. I was just in South America on some work, and it was made pretty clear, and I think a real interesting point, that who do you think held the altitude record probably until this century, definitely at the 20th century? Who on earth held the altitude record for human beings until the 20th century?
The Incas.
Yeah, the Incas, or even the pre-Incas, who those maidens, let's call them, that's a funny word to use, but they find these sacrificial victims, I think usually women, at, I don't know how high the highest one is, 6,500 meters, 7,000 meters, I mean 20,000 feet on some of the Andean peaks, perfectly preserved because of the dry conditions and the cold, freeze-dried mummies from 1,000 years ago. There's one in the museum in Arequipa, kept under the same conditions in which they found her, on the nearby volcano that's as high as Kilimanjaro. And it doesn't look it, because you're so much higher already at a place like Arequipa on the Altiplano. So the Latin American natives were by far way higher than this, a millennium ago at least. But Europeans started getting organized to do this, and they started climbing around it. 1786 is when? It's 3 years before the French Revolution. It's 3 years before the Continental Congress here. It's 10 years after the Declaration of Independence. So back then, in George Washington's time, Benjamin Franklin's time, they were starting in the summers leading up to 1786 to want to try to climb this mountain. So curiosity, and what else does mountaineering take? Bravado. What else does it take? Why do people climb mountains? If we have time, I'd like to read a little bit from the recommended reading I put in the bookstore for this series.
Curiosity.
Because they're there, the old answer. Okay, is that good enough, though?
God.
They've always been there. Why weren't they climbed before?
You get some solitude. You get
better equipment.
Sometimes you get the idea of being closer to God.
Closer to God.
How about fame?
Nationalism?
Fame. Fame, okay.
Yeah, you have to question whether somewhere sane.
Nationalism?
Nationalism.
Yeah. Why'd they draw the boundary on the other side? You know?
Pushing limits.
Yeah, pushing limits.
And really, how do you know that that was when the first people ascended? I mean, maybe it wasn't written down and other people did it. Or...
Very good point.
How about that frozen fellow they found way up?
Yeah, he's on the Italian side.
And that was... He was very primitive.
In the Dolomites? He was at about 12,000 feet. Mm-hmm. And he was dressed as a hunter, so he was probably hunting. But yeah, it's a phenomenal story. And Austria and Italy are arguing about who gets to keep him.
I think nationalism, too, that in the first ascent of the Matterhorn, there was real competition for which nation would reach it first.
Yeah. I don't think it's an accident that, you know, the pioneers of European mountaineering were in exactly the same time frame as the colonial and imperial expansion of Europe around the world. It's the sort of mentality that we're number one and we do these kind of things, with all of the reasons you've given to support that. So in 1786, a Swiss gentleman named de Saussure had put up a prize that he would give to the first people who climbed Mont Blanc. Why Swiss? Because he lived in Geneva, he was a Genevois, and Geneva is only an hour's drive, 50 miles from here, and it may be the nearest point of civilization. You know, the city of Calvin, it has a long history, and so there's always a link between Geneva and the area, the Haute-Savoie of France here, which includes Chamonix. And Saussure had this prize out, and various people had been trying to go up and were trying in the summers. And the first climb took place by two people, one of whom was a chamois hunter. You know, chamois, the little deer that you wash your car with? Mm-hmm. he was a chamois hunter, and chamois can go anywhere. And so if he was hunting them, he probably had gone a lot of places. He was also a crystal gatherer. There's interesting minerals in the Alps, and you can get some money for some of the crystals you find. And his name was Jacques Balma, and he teamed up with a village doctor, a guy named Paccard, and the two of them left their homes separately by different routes and went through the back alleys on August 7th, 1786, at, I think, pretty late in the day, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Because other people were trying it, and the weather had just improved. They'd been delayed. They'd been trying to do it for several weeks. And they slipped out and met up and went on their way. They spent the night here, I think. Here or here. I can't remember which of these rocky bars. I think it was here, because I remember they crossed the glacier in the night. And then they climbed the next day, and they made it to the summit at 8 p.m. on August 8th. 1786. And I'll pass around some pictures, as well as the newspaper, La Suisse, which was put out the next day of the 200th anniversary. So here we are, the La Suisse of 7th, or the day of the climb, 7th August. And since it's Switzerland, a little nationalism in the editorial decision, they didn't show a picture of Chamonix, of Mont Blanc, of the French guides who were impersonating the two first climbers that day in period costume and climbing the mountain according to the same schedule as those two guys did 200 years ago. And I'll show you what they were wearing in a second. They put on the front a drawing we had in the clubhouse of the Swiss Alpine Club, a painting of de Saussure, who went himself. He was sort of a gentleman of letters and science. He went himself the next year and climbed it successfully in 1787. And the caption here says, the climb of Saussure to Mont Blanc in August of 87, with his valet and 18 guides. And it credits the Swiss Alpine Club for where they got the picture. Then, if you turn, I'll pass this around and you look inside. If you turn to the inside, you see the two Chamonix guides, and the guy playing Paccard, the doctor here, had climbed it 300 times as a guide in the Chamonix Valley. And they're dressed in the period costumes. You take a look at the leggings instead of gaiters. The sole total of their equipment was a staff, a wooden staff, nothing else. Boots with, I suppose, I hope, maybe they figured out to put some hobnails sticking out of their boots, but that was what early mountaineers used. Whether they had figured that out yet, I don't know. And you get a sense for some of the villagers dressed up in period costume in Chamonix to celebrate the day of the 200th anniversary and one of the parades that took place there. So I'll pass that around. And
can you pass those separately? It'd probably be easier than opening and closing it regularly.
That's a good idea. So here is the first one. We'll start back here. And here's the second one. And then I'm going to pass around some other pictures to go with it as well. Pictures taken by me on that day. And I'll just explain what they are. Paccard and Balma wore felt hats, and so did the two guys who impersonated them. And at one point, we were with those two guys, and one of them had a can of Coke. So we have a little anachronism. Here's Paccard and Balma posing, the impersonators posing on the glacier. You can see a nice crevasse behind them. This is up on above the ground plateau. Here they are looking to the summit and pretending that they were finding their way up that route. Here they are being filmed for a live feed to Paris at lunchtime and to Geneva for the noon news shows. This is my friend Yves, the fellow I climbed, a Parisian guy who was studying in Geneva, on the summit with a little bit of what the clouds do to you at that altitude when it's cold. They give your beard a nice little frosting that you don't have to pay for. This is yours truly. In the same condition as Eve. And here are Paccard and Balma climbing. On our way down, we crossed paths with them and talked to them a little while, the two guides. And the wooden piece on the Balma character's back is a barometer, just like the real Balma carried, because Paccard, the gentleman, wanted to measure the barometric pressure at the top and therefore establish the height of the mountain. Here's a picture of some of the seracs on the Bossons Glacier with the summit behind, and you can see the actual summit of Mont Blanc and how sort of what a hump that it is. And then the finale of the day was a string of flares planted along the historic route from Chamonix at 1,000 meters all the way to the top at 4,607 meters that were lit and went off boom, 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 boom up the mountain. For the finale of the 200th anniversary. Has anybody been to some European summer festivals? They know how to do things there, and so it's kind of a neat day to be hanging out in Chamonix and on Mont Blanc. I'll pass those around, and you can see what they mean. Just a couple more things about the history of mountaineering. Balma, in that same summer, had been up with another party, had come back to Chamonix at like 5 p.m. and met some other people who were setting out who probably wanted him to come with them because maybe he was good. And so he went home, you know, grabbed a sandwich and went right back out again and went up with them and went up to within 2,000 feet of the top. So he was up here somewhere and maybe he found the route he needed then. They stayed back on a rocky outcrop somewhere, and he went on to prospect the next day. When he came back to the outcrop, they were gone. And so he was alone on his third night on the mountain. And remember, all this is done with felt and wool, and I don't know, did they have oil skin? I have no idea, but basically nothing waterproof. And so he elected, this chamois hunter, elected to spend the night under some rocks And he said he would have gone back up to the top, but the weather wasn't very good, to try to find the top himself. So I think a lot of credit goes to the local chamois hunter. Well, the French were responsible for conquering Mont Blanc, if you want to use that term. It's important to follow through a little bit on the history of mountaineering in Switzerland and give credit to the English, because this was an early shot. But anybody know when, for example, the Matterhorn was first climbed? You get bonus points if you can name the year or the person.
Is that Edward Whymper?
Yeah, Edward Whymper. Whymper, a British painter who went to paint the Alps, kind of a gentleman, adventurer type, 1865. Went to paint the Alps and got so enthusiastic painting and looking at them that he started climbing them. And a great book to read if you want to is his book called Scrambles Amongst the Alps. And he describes levels of deprivation and discomfort that we probably wouldn't even think were worth doing. You know, a night in a cave with water trickling down your back, with everything wet around you. And he puts in a phrase, "We had an uncomfortable night." You know, he gets on with the story. But you know, no plastic, no nylon,
no freeze-dried food,
no light food, no equipment to speak of. So it's really something to think about how determined and tough these people were. Anybody know when the Eiger was first climbed, or who did that? Again, bonus points. It's a guy named Heinrich Harrer, and they made a movie called 7 Years in Tibet. The popular culture takes over here where education has failed. Heinrich Harrer had a very interesting life afterwards, but in 1937 he was a young Austrian, I believe, who was in that mode where as a university student, it was almost like a Nazi-related climbing expedition, because the Nazis were so strong in Germany at the time that to do things you had to be more or less at ease with their system. And he climbed it with a little bit of nationalist overtones, climbed the north wall of the Eiger in, I think, 21 days or 27 days. People do it now in 8 hours. But an incredible story, if you read some of his books. And then later, he became the tutor of the Dalai Lama when he escaped from prison camp in India and walked to Tibet in his prison clothes and became the tutor of the Dalai Lama. And the book, 7 Years in Tibet, is a fantastic book. 5, 6, 7 times better than the movie. So just by way of saying, mountaineering progressed, and there were still tough routes being done for the first time into the 50s in the Alps. But pretty much all the peaks have been climbed by the middle part of the last century, or the earlier third of the last century. And then, of course, Everest was climbed in 52. And then hard peaks in the Himalayas being climbed into the 60s and 70s, and pretty much everything has been climbed today, but always tougher routes. You know, if there's a tougher way to go up it, somebody will try it. What I'd like to do is read you a little story I wrote about that day. So if you want to close your eyes and turn on your imagination, sit back and listen, I'll read this. But are there any questions or comments? Yeah.
What kind of food did they have on these early days, you know?
Bread, sausage, cheese, things that would keep. In that climate, you can carry food for quite a long time. You know, just like the lunch line up here, apples.
And there was no Giardia, right?
No Giardia. Some things were better. Maybe fire they would make, but certainly not stoves, you know, not 6 ounce stoves. So in New Guinea, we used to carry firewood, because we didn't have a camping stove, and the New Guineans would carry firewood, so we carried firewood up to where it was cold and wet and there weren't any trees. So imagine carrying firewood because you want to cook that night.
You mentioned that as many as 100 people may die a year.
Right.
on this. What is the local attitude towards that? I mean, is there an attempt to? I mean, we've been through this with Mount Hood several times.
Yeah.
But they just try to shut the thing down. Nobody goes up there anymore. It's too dangerous. Quit going up.
No.
People get killed. What's the attitude?
Bonnie, maybe you can comment as a European resident.
Well, it's interesting to me that the Europeans and the Americans, we think of the Americans as being individualistic and having, you know, cowboy mentality, and we'll go out there and risk our lives if we feel like it. But actually, in America, a lot of these things, as you were saying this morning, are much more strictly controlled. Risk-taking is much more strictly regulated. And in Europe, it's pretty much everybody for themselves.
Yeah, much more literate.
And so even, for example, if you get lost, I don't know if you've had this experience, John, but the Swiss will not come and get you. It will not come and rescue you unless you have in advance purchased
right.
their insurance.
Oh.
And arranged for them to get you. So there's a very definitely a different attitude.
Here it becomes a huge media event. Everybody's out there.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, I think that's exactly right.
Costly.
We have tied up with a huge tourist industry, and hey, you did a silly thing. We'll help you if we can, but.
Well, it was so bizarre. I mean, this situation, the last situation, was so bizarre.
The one with the helicopter
and
stuff?
The extent that they'll go to
right.
risk equipment, people,
yeah.
resources, everything.
Somebody would probably sue if they didn't do that, though.
You know, in Australia, it's crazy. Rescuing people that in the Great Southern Ocean in these yachts,
right.
the French and Europeans, and it costs us millions of dollars to go and rescue them from the huge Southern Ocean. That it seems strange that they're expecting that kind of rescue there, but won't do it from their own country.
Well, you're the fools, I guess.
I guess, yeah. But we also went to the Grand Canyon, and we heard that vast numbers of people every year just step backwards taking photographs of the Grand Canyon. And they don't want it publicized. This is what our guide told us. And the guide we with said, look, we were there in winter, and she was really anxious the whole time because it's icy at the edge.
Right.
And then just said, I'm never bringing people to this particular spot again, but it was a bit crumbly. Said, I know of 21 people that have stepped backwards this year alone.
Yeah.
They don't publicize it. And we said, why don't you put, you know, more guide things? She said, well, people have got to be responsible for their own actions.
Travel at your own risk. We will not come and rescue you.
Well, they won't rescue in the Grand Canyon during certain periods because of the unpredictable airflow down there, too.
Really?
Yeah, it's at your own risk.
In Nepal, they sell insurance, helicopter rescue insurance that you can buy. And you can, if you don't have the insurance, you can call for a helicopter too. Somebody will radio it. But when it shows up, it's a $7,000 rescue fee. Mm-hmm. And if you don't exhibit green cash or a plastic card, they won't put you on. They just head right on back to Kathmandu.
Oh,
that's a poor country, and they're not out giving free expensive service.
These are tough questions. You know, where does responsibility lie?
Well, what about Holden? That beautiful stretch right here, they've got the orange plastic to keep you away from...
By the bridge?
Yeah. Is that risk management kind of problem?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Somebody decided that they needed to have some sort of way of keeping people from falling there. But it's been it's been open for years.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Holden's trying to get the Forest Service to take responsibility for it.
But are they worried about some child falling off of there, or they're
just worried about the road getting away?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm amazed that in Europe how often, you know, you could step off something like no barrier at the Grand Canyon type of thing. Okay. Chairlifts that are 100 meters off the ground with no bar. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like use your head. Mm-hmm. Driving. I mean, look at the way the Germans drive. Are any of our German friends here? But, you know, Germany, the world's most rational and hardworking and focused country, will look you straight in the eye and say, it's faster, it's safer to go fast, because you get there quicker. I've had Germans tell me that. So a Mercedes passes you at 240 kilometers an hour, and that's safe. When it's 140 kilometers faster than you, no, that's not safe. And they have twice as many fatalities as we do. But I have to say, American speeds are climbing up too. Mm-hmm. Out east, everybody goes 75 all the time. All the time, 80 even.
Yeah.
90, you can go 90 and not, nobody
can hardly look.
Pardon?
What's your speed limit?
Well, theoretically it's 70, isn't it?
Yeah. 60, 65, 70, depending.
But with smoking, driving, and hiking, Europe lives with a lot more risk and worries about it less. So the 100 people a year are kind of, compare them to the 500,000 who come. Mm-hmm. And they probably did something silly. We like the altitude, we like our nature, we like to share it with you, but if you can't be in yourself, it's more relaxed.
And they're probably thinking natural selection, too. If you make a mistake, you shouldn't be out there anymore.
Well, I don't know if they have to go that far, but...
Let's hear the story.
Yeah, the story is a little bit of a mixture of what we did and what Jack Palma and Packard did. In the late 18th century, scientists and romantics in Europe took new interest in high mountains. The Alpine heights were seen as laboratories for the forces of nature. Their valleys gained some of their present-day renown as idyllic places of fresh air, forest, and alp. An alp basically means pasture. In the dukedom of Savoy, in the mountain village of Chamonix, life began to change as a result of this interest. Two hotels were built in the 1770s, along with a road into the valley. More travelers came to visit from England, France, and Geneva. The young Johann Wolfgang von Goethe was one who passed through, describing the blue skies, peaks, and cloud formations as a veritable feast for his eyes. Chamonix lay at the foot of the highest mountain in Europe, a mountain known as the Mont Maudit, which means accursed or devil mountain. But the attitude behind the name was clearly changing. In the 1770s, a gentleman scientist from nearby Geneva, Horace Benedict de Saussure, offered a reward to the first person to climb what was also becoming known as Mont Blanc. During the summer of 1786, various attempts by Chamonillards and others continued, as in previous years. Then two locals, a chamois hunter and a crystal gatherer, Jacques Balma, and the village doctor, Michel-Gabriel Paccard, planned an attempt together. Bad weather in midsummer delayed them until August 7. On August 7, 200 years later, we were looking down on Chamonix from the steep north flank of Mont Blanc. After 2 hours, my climbing partner and I had reached the height where valley sounds fade away, but where one can still see much detail in the valley below. We watched the crowds gathering, as if for a marathon, along a route from the village church to the base of the famous mountain. They were gathering for a reenactment of the first ascent by two Chamonix guides sporting the laced cuffs and meager climbing gear of 1786. The real Balma and Paccard had also started in mid-afternoon like this, but not with cheering crowds. Each had left secretly from his own side of the village to avoid alerting any possible competitors. Helicopters shuttled up and down the mountainside all afternoon. One appeared to leave with the reenactment exactly at 3 and climbed rapidly up, passing near us, tracing the historic route, probably filming it, in fact, 5,000 feet high, then 10,000, and finally all the way to the top of the mountain, some 13,000 feet above the village. It paused a moment and then came back down. It took only about 20 minutes for the round trip by air. Balma and Paccard had taken 30 hours to reach the top. At high noon that day, our own first ascent had begun while we were still on the highway. Climbers used to have to walk to a mountain before climbing it. Now they usually drive, at least part of the way. But whenever one first sees the chosen mountain, an element of the approach march is retained. From inside our moving car, some 14,000 feet below on the freeway, we could already see the summit ridge of Mont Blanc. Up there, clearly visible in the snow, was a path heading for the top that we could see from the freeway. It was like recognizing something on the moon, an unexpected detail seen at a great distance. We stopped to have a better look, saying to each other that we would be up there by this time tomorrow. At that moment, we'd just begun to leave our everyday lives behind. After seeing our goal and entering, unnoticed, the compressed but slower time zone of mountain climbing. The pace of everyday life still flowed around us, however, right up to and even through the mountain.
a truck carrying $1 million worth of red Ferraris roared by, fresh from Italy in a factory via the Mont Blanc tunnel. We left our car near the mouth of the tunnel to Italy and continued on foot, zigzagging up the slope of the village to a height of some 6,500 feet before turning towards the summer ice on our right. Here was the Bossong Glacier, which would take us, like the first climbers, almost to the top. While we stopped to prepare ourselves, I counted the returning climbers as a measure of the mountain's popularity on the eve of its anniversary. 20 people came off the glacier during the time we took with our crampons and ropes. One man told us it was dangerous to sit where we were because of falling rocks. It was a reminder that, although our route was not particularly dangerous, even it had claimed a share of the 6,000 people who have died on Mont Blanc in these past 200 years. At some places out on the glacier, we could hear crisp noises coming from deep inside. This did not fit with the glacier's surface appearance, which was mute and messy, as if a dirty mountain basin had been drained long ago and all the debris was left stranded on the ice or in it. The glacier looked as if it had once been active, obviously able to have made such a mess, but that now it was only melting. Periodically through the 17th and 18th centuries, before the mountain was first scaled, this glacier and the others of Chamonix were actually on the rampage. At one time, the threat was so bad that the Bishop of Geneva was brought in to exorcise the glaciers. At other times, lesser holy men had blessed these frozen intruders to keep them back from hamlets and pastures. The noise we were hearing seemed like a sign of both life and time. It was running water, of course, and what was more, meltwater, which had only been water again for a little while. Meltwater from when? Surely we were walking on something which had been here for Balma and Pakar. Rocks, yes, but they link one to the distant past. Frozen water is more specific to a recent time, something coming back to life. Maybe some of what we were hearing fell as snow 200 years ago. The ice began to get rougher. Ahead and just to the right of our course, we sighted a peninsula of rock jutting up from the valley. This was the Montagne de la Côte, the last piece of the mainland below. It's here. And with these promontories of rock pointing up into the mountain and all the snow and ice above them, you feel like you're leaving land and entering a sea of snow and ice. And so the promontories of rock are like peninsulas that jut out into the sea, and the sea surrounds them. And if you stepped off the peninsula into the sea, you're making a transition. That's how the mountain feels when it's got so much snow and it's so big. Here was the jumping off place for the early attempts. Here was where Balma and Packard had slept, and where the two Chamonix guides would sleep tonight, the two reenactors. Around this rocky headland, the sea of ice is always stormy. The rock stands against the tide, breaking and twisting all the ice that ages have sent its way. The scene is one of frozen cause and effect. An 18th century French visitor called it an ancient empire of chaos. We are already deep inside this empire and past the headland, working our way higher and deeper towards an island of rock at 10,000 feet. Atop the rock, perched like a squat lighthouse, that's the bar on the left down there where the hut is. Perched like a squat lighthouse was our goal, an alpine club hut where we would spend the night, or part of it at least. At 2:15 next morning, I looked down from that clubhouse on several strings of fireflies moving slowly up the mountain, small lights weakly stabbing the ice. They were rope teams of climbers who had risen at the recommended time for an early start. At 3:23, we were in their tracks. My partner Eve's new batteries were somehow flat. So whenever we crossed a crevasse, I shined my headlamp back for him. Otherwise, he made do with the night, including the slight illumination from the towns in the valley below. He said it was more tiring in the dark without a light. We soon met some lights coming down, Austrians who had started early, but having just arrived the day before, now found themselves too high too soon. They said they would try again tomorrow. Through these small hours, a steady surge of mental energy accompanied the climbing rhythm. I decided to memorize my train of thought using the alphabet to remind me of what I was thinking. A was for the altitude-sick Austrians. B was for bandits, time bandits. For the Austrians in too much of a hurry, and for us, so conscious of time. Both of us wanted to get back to work. the next day. We had finally decided that we could not join in the reenactment. We would not follow any of the historic route at the historic pace. It would simply take too long. That was the original plan, was to walk with those guys, or right as close as they would let us. But it would take too long. First, we had thought we'd leave Chamonix with the two guys and go all the way. Then we thought we would intercept and join them in these early morning hours of August 8th as they passed our hut. But then we heard that they would not reach the summit until the real historic time of 8:23 that evening, like Balmain-Paccard 200 years ago. So we decided to just climb Mont Blanc on that day, but on a modern schedule. We would wait for them on the Grand Plateau at 13,000 feet on the way back down. C was for all the crevasses we avoided, especially the ones big enough to swallow semi-trailers. It was also for the lights of Chamonix, and for the corruption that was going through my brain. Oh, Chamonix, I long to see you. Which I sang in the dark using the name of the town below us. D was for Dormir, the extra hour of sleep we took before starting. It must have helped, because we both felt good. E was for the modern era, which includes so much that crowds out time. In our case, the jobs, the money, the mobility to dash off to the mountains, the equipment to travel light, the high alpine huts with wardens, which obviate camping and tents and extra food to be carried. F was for my footsteps, which sometimes fell too fast. I had to try to keep a pace, which I felt I could keep all day. G was for God, who made the night and the world around us. The people in the towns below us were somehow needlessly displacing too much of that night. There were so many lights still burning at 3 o'clock in the morning. Tonight, to celebrate the bicentennial, the whole mountain would be illuminated. First, fireworks on all flanks, and then a line of torches would burn like a giant fuse, lighting the historic route up the mountain all the way to the top. We had to hurry back to Chamonix to see the spectacle. At 4:40 a.m., we met a group of four people descending. They said it was blowing and snowing up higher, and that it was wise for them to turn back. Their tone of voice implied that it might be wise for us to turn back, too. But we continued, thinking that the weather would improve by the time we got higher. Maybe our late start would help us in the end. 6:20, on the Grand Plateau, another rope team of four climbers retreating, citing the cold wind and the altitude. As the leader spoke, the third man in the line stepped off the track and vomited numbly. It was about here that Balma had wanted badly to turn back. He had left his three-week-old daughter at home, sick. Dr. Paccard, who had probably delivered the child, persuaded him to continue. Your doctor tells you not to go back and take care of your daughter. Paccard had then began taking his turn and making the track, and even took some of Balma's load, so your doctor tells you to keep going and then take some of your load, including a meter-long barometer in a wooden case. Balma's instincts were correct, it turned out, because his infant daughter died during that day while he was climbing. Ahead and to the left above the Grand Plateau lay two bars of rock, the two X lines I drew there. And between them, the original route to the summit. So what they did is they went from here where they slept, probably something like this, and then like this, and then to the summit that way. Mm-hmm. Between those two really pitched and vertical bars of rock that have some not bad snow between them. We would not go that way because of the danger of ice avalanches. A better route went to the right, up a safer slope, and joined the long northwesterly summit ridge. It was hard to imagine why Balma and Paccard did not go that way, or the Geneva professor Saussure on his successful attempt a year later. Indeed, the guidebook attributes this route to a much later date, an expedition in 1859. Who knows how much more difficult it was to be the first? One already had enough to do accepting so many unknowns, persisting and enduring. Jacques Balma had certainly shown his mettle earlier in that summer of 1786. Returning from one climb, he had met another party just starting out and was invited to join them. He went home for provisions and started back up at 11 o'clock at night, catching up with the party atop the Montagne de la Côte at 2 in the morning and continuing on. Later that day, probably within 2,000 feet of the summit, he went on alone to reconnoiter, and when he returned, he found his comrades had gone back without him. Instead of following them down, he took courage to go back up, those are his words, according to his diary, getting high enough to look over into what is now Italy and possibly finding the way he and Packard would later take. The summit remained blocked in cloud, and he descended to the Grand Plateau, where he met both the night and a huge crevasse which he could not cross in the dark. He climbed back to the shelter of some rocks and spent the night without cover at an altitude of 13,000 feet, a special kind of mountaineering first. Maybe the Incas accepted there. All night long, he rubbed his hands and stamped his feet while his clothes and hair froze. The next morning, he was still interested in the summit, he said, but he gave up when the sun did not burn off the cloud. Cloud was not to lift on the anniversary day either. Mont Blanc kept its summit to itself and to those who approached on foot. Above 13,000 feet, we climbed in a cold, gray, and featureless world. With the cloud came a stiffening wind, just strong enough to make the long summit ridge more difficult. It blew from our right, where the biggest of the two drop-offs which flanked us was invisible in the mist. In the final 2 hours of our ascent, I counted 70 people coming back from the top. 70. This was almost the number of visitors Chamonix received in the whole season 200 years ago. We usually passed with only a grunt of greeting in one language or the other. The 47th person said on passing, "Nous avons eu un accident," in German-accented French. But it was not clear what he meant, what kind. We have had an accident, but it wasn't clear what kind. The 56th person was an Englishman from Suffolk, a fitting type given the English place in Alpine history. We did not see any of the more recent visitors, Americans or Japanese, but overtook a lone Italian who asked us if we had seen his partners anywhere in the fog. We did not know if we had. The 67th was another solo, Swiss-German perhaps, who asked if he could wait below and join our rope to cross the glacier on the way down. I was sorry to be walking blind, though I knew where we were from the view of our balcony in Geneva, 50 miles away. Mont Blanc sits like a great crooked throne, obliquely facing Chamonix and points north, offering the silhouette by which it is best known. A supporting cast of rocky points and snowy domes rise to support the summit, yet give it pride of place. This is the view on the postcard sold from Chamonix to Geneva and beyond. We are definitely close to the top. The red, white, and blue strap on my ice axe snapped flag-like in the wind. A wind up here had blown Packard's hat off 200 years before. The track was mostly brittle ice, crushed by all the crampons into the fixings for a fresh bottle of champagne. I tried to remember such details with another memory aid, small A this time, small B, but it didn't work. Nothing was as interesting as before, and my memory seemed weak. When we reached the summit, there was only more of the misty void. The track kept right on going, over the top and down towards Italy. The top of Europe is an arched ridge, not a pinnacle, so there is no exact point on which to stand. We photographed each other, taking care that there was nothing untoward in the background, such as the three tents off to one side, presumably related to the festivities for the anniversary. A few people by the tents, also related to the festivities, took no notice of two more climbers, and we did not talk to them. We huddled briefly behind the snowbank, as if we had to experience the moment for a while. But there was really nothing much to do, except to go back down. All told, we spent 12 minutes on the top, after 12 hours of climbing time from Chamonix. The world was waiting when we got back to the glacial shelf on the Grand Plateau. 24 French television people had already arrived by helicopter to set up for the live news report from Mont Blanc at 1 o'clock. They were ready with a star climber, a famous mountaineering author, a weatherman, a reporter, and of course two guys from Chamonix going to do the whole show from the Grand Plateau. Till then, on Bicentennial Day, this busy mountain had the space to let us and many others observe the Bicentennial with relative dignity. It was, nevertheless, an ironic occasion. We were commemorating a brave and solitary deed, but also a violation of sorts, the first of many such, and therefore somehow saddening. Still, I felt the mountain had easily held its own. As we climbed into its realm of space and time, space had grown and time had slowed and fallen away, unsuited, perhaps, for the exertion. The mountain filled in our footsteps as we went up. We knew that to descend was to re-enter, and at the Grand Plateau we came upon a sudden re-entry. We could have had a gentler ending if we had walked right past the television cameras. But the mood on this part of the mountain was different. A helicopter landed, and a reporter for the magazine Perry Match jumped out and ran over to take our picture, attracted by the Arctic frost in our hair and beards. I took his picture in return. We learned that for the noontime television audience, the star climber was to have jumped from the top of Mont Blanc by parasail, but the day was too windy. We talked to the two guides, Bauma and Packard, who were having a hard time keeping warm in their 1786 clothes. For the interlude, they put on modern parkas against the wind that swept down from the summit. A TV personality looked over his nose. A weatherman posed by his colorful computer map with friends. Meanwhile, the French army came by, wiring the climbing route with the evening's torches. Our first ascent was somehow over, whether commemoration as we had meant or violation as some of all this mountain traffic must be. Our moment was over, but here was the outside world still trying to have its moment with television bandits waiting 2.5 miles high to ambush a couple of mountain travelers from the 18th century. We decided to wait with them and watch a while. That evening when we reached Chamonix, we found the valley full of cars. Some 200,000 people had come for the bicentennial from throughout the region. When night fell, fireworks lifted it again in a sound and light climax to the celebration. From the church steeple in the village square, from ski gondolas moving in the dark, from the skyline overhead, and then from helicopters higher still, Mont Blanc was illuminated with flares, rockets, and music. Then the line of torches was lit along the route of the first climb. The fires scaled the rocky Montagne de la Côte, picked their way across the crevasses and seracs of the Bossan Glacier, disappeared over the edge of the Grand Plateau, and then came back into view, turning upwards again toward the summit ridge. Before the ridge, the torches disappeared again, reaching clouds which were still there, our clouds. It seemed that the fuse had gone out, that this particular commemoration would not reach the top. But after a moment, the whole cloud covering the summit lit up from within as if by lightning. A bomb was a sort of a huge firework bomb was at the top of the flares. Mont Blanc had been conquered again. Let me just say one more thing. There are three zones in alpine hiking, which you've seen in action today. A lot of people can have a lot of fun if you just stay in the villages that are throughout the Alps. And they, in Switzerland at least, climb to about 1,700 meters. You can find people living at 1,700 meters, which is 6,500 feet. So there's zone one. And you get the beautiful Swiss villages and the pastures and all the stuff that is on the postcards and is very justly deserved by that country for how pretty it is. Then you get a zone up to about 3,000 feet where, I think 3,000 feet is roughly the highest regular cabin.
Meters.
3,000 meters. So 10,000 feet. So from 1,700 to 3,000 you have mountain huts. So there's one, and they're everywhere. And what hiking tends to be is a trip from a village to a hut, wherever height it is, and then through some valleys and passes to another hut and down to another village. And you have beautiful hikes just in that zone between 3,000 meters and including the village, 3,000 meters and below. And that's hiking. And there aren't trail limits, as far as I know, anywhere. And where there's a cable car like this, you can get thousands of people on these trails. And if you want to have a lot of company in the Alps, go where there are cable cars and restaurants, and you'll have a lot of company. If you don't want to have company, go to other mountains where none of that exists, and you won't have that much company. The Alpine Club section I'm a member of has a cabin. All the sections run the different cabins, the Alpine cabins, near a cable car near the Matterhorn, and there are 6,000 or 8,000 people a night, a year, sleeping in that cabin, and it's not a very big place. From 3,000 up to whatever the summits are, you have sort of the climbing zone, and so what is a goal for a hiker becomes a starting point for a climber. And the mountain huts tend to have a mixture of hikers and climbers. The hikers are at a resting place and maybe even a high point in their walk, and the climbers are getting ready to go up to something on the top. And all of this means that you don't camp. You're not allowed to camp in Switzerland. You camp very high if you're climbing something and you have to camp. You can get away with that, but you're not allowed to camp basically in this zone, if you follow the rules. And even up high, they have things like this. They're called bivouacs or refuges, and that's really just a tin shed. It's like climbing into somebody's, you know, tool shed and getting out of the wind. Little tiny place, might sleep 10 people. And some are just perched on the edges of incredible places and get blown away by the snows or wiped out by avalanches. But that's sort of the zone, the way hiking is handled. And the presence of all those refuges takes a load off the environment. It allows you to eat nicely. These refuges have summer wardens. You know, you see ads in the Swiss papers. Refuge wardens needed for such and such a cabin. And you and your wife, or you and your husband, go there and work for the summer. And you have to cook. And you have to probably clean. Donkeys used to, and now increasingly helicopters. And sometimes even vehicles.
Cables that bring just materials and cable cars. People.
Yeah.
How much would it cost to stay in one of those?
If you're a member of the Swiss Alpine Club, it's, I think, 15 Swiss francs, which is about 10 bucks. If you're not a member, it can be 30 Swiss francs, 20 bucks. They're pretty reasonable. You get a mattress in a bunk room, and men and women can be mixed, and you get some wonderful scenes, you know, where people sing songs, and they bring up wine, and they have parties at night, and they do fondues. The club might offer a fondue or a raclette, which is a melted cheese dish on potatoes. So I'm going over time here. Ooh, badly. Sorry. Hey,
good
memories. Good memories of mountain huts. So go hiking in Switzerland sometime and walk around Mont Blanc. Thank you for coming.
My husband had a lawyer, and we were working on this project together. And all of a sudden, we got this letter from his office. He was a partner in this group, and we get a letter from his office, and it was apologizing because he had been lost in the Alps, lost in the avalanche. Until today, they've never found him.
Somebody you worked with.
My husband's lawyer, he was working with on a project. Yeah. And it was so shocking to get a letter that says that someone is lost.
Right.
And we had to read it over and over again. And we called the office, and then we thought, hey, this might be a setup, because maybe he had a bunch of money at the Swiss bank account instead of disappearance. But we were just totally... overwhelmed
that
someone would get lost and
they
can't
find them. Yeah. There were, I think, five. Hey, somebody left the knife. Swiss Army knife.
That's me.
Oh, fitting.
Yeah, I know.
There were about five people killed when I was living there in our section. By avalanches. No. Two of them involved in falling. A slip. But, that was bad because they hadn't lost anybody for 20 years. And I went to the funerals, and I was. It's one of those moments when you really feel the absence of a viable religion. Because, you know, Europe is so secular that you come to a death, and many people have nothing to deal with it around, you know. So you have this totally secular moment at the funeral home. It just got really empty. And the eulogies are, you know.
That's nice to have a bunch of
objects. I mean, I like hiking, I like mountains, but good Lord, I would hate to have them mentioned when I die. And that's all they can do. They started describing, this one guy described his routes, what he had done, as sort of his legacy. But I really felt hollow. And I just, it kind of chilled my bones to think that this much fun was taking place in that kind of a vacuum. You know, for me, it's a very occasional hobby. And you know, religion is such a bigger, and your faith is such a bigger issue. And these people died. One guy had like no family, no friends. He even showed up. He was like, man, you know, a life of his own. It was really, really an interesting kind of eye-opener about the society you're living in and what, you know, how little people have supporting them to deal with this. And I actually asked when one guy died, they asked, because they knew me and because I knew I worked for the church, they asked me to say something. It's like they're desperate for a word of
comfort.
Something metaphysical, you know? I didn't know him that well. It was really a kind of a poor choice. But you know, sort of a side you don't get to when you talk about. Look at that.
Isn't that?
Did you make that?
Yep, I have three of them that are going to get put in the fire ring.
Wow.
For the forever?
Well, no.
Till you take them home?
That really adds a lot.
Isn't that beautiful? The colors. Oh, just magnificent. It brings out colors in the.
Yeah. It's perfect.
Look at the face.
Frozen.
They look like they're still on fire, don't they?
They do it.
Oh, they
you know,
do.
They key off of the rock and you know what you're doing.
Well, and we have a spotlight, somebody said, that's up here that could go down on that. Where you could put
Without realizing, I've always sort of felt that sand ring was a little blah.
Well, I was happy to see flowers in it this time.
Have you tried Everett's?
No.
What's that?
I'd love to, but... it's so expensive now. I mean,
and there's so many people going up and
down. No, it's just, it's... I should have, you know, made that a goal when I was 20. But, you know, you have to... That's getting out of whack. I mean, you
want me to hand them to you when you're in there, or...?
Sure.
Let's see.
Oh, I'll take the flowers. Oh, they're just stunning.
Now, I'm probably gonna... Let's see. I'm not sure... exactly what I want to do. I guess I'm going to put them in a... I'll have to try different ways.
It'll be good.
These are magnificent. We'll have to take a
photo. Oh, they're on a pole inside? Or?
Yeah,
oh,
they're on a dowel.
Okay.
Do they need the dowel?
Yeah, they do.
Oh,
this
look
one
at
definitely
their faces.
Does. Yes, faces are beautiful. See, so you guys can give me your critiques on how you think. In some ways, I like to have them facing.
Face out.
Face out, I think. Okay.
Or no? Maybe what you got? This one's sort of half in, half out. Those two facing
people
who can see
it. Yeah, she looks like she's going around the circle.
Oh.
Well, these are beautiful.
These people can see them from. Different angles, which is nice.
Take my breath away. And did you see that in your mind?
Yeah, kind of. Oh, they're beautiful. So, facing out, whatever. This kind of looks up.
A grooved effect, regular grooved effect.
You can change them, like, daily.
You might want to...
So they'll be doing different things.
Not just mimic the ring with the plane of the... Yeah, kind of be more, a little bit more random. I don't know. I think that's a bit... And maybe...
try it and see what you think of
that. Because now these two are the same?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Here. I like them there.
Mm-hmm.
They're spaced out.
Oh,
nicely.
And you know the light shines on those stripes from here.
Yeah.
How did you get the stripe effect?
I use a tool that goes and impresses into the clay. It's a rolling tool.
Mm. All right.
That's beautiful.
Just thanks. Gorgeous. Yeah, I think they should be okay to close out.
This doesn't add to it.
The water bottle in the eye.
Beautiful.
Okay. Wonderful lunch. Thank you.
Oh, I was glad I was there when you walked in.